Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. This week, in our reinvention story, you'll meet Shondell Atkinson, a woman who made enormous changes in her own life and is now working to change the lives of others. We'll also hear from WISO Archives Fellow Jocelyn Robinson as this week marked another anniversary of the Great Dayton Flood. Also in today's program, WISO News Director Emily McCord with Politics Ohio. Up first, the U.S. Air Force has announced a new commander for NASIC, the National Air and Space Intelligence Center. Colonel Leah Lauterbach will replace Colonel Aaron M. Prupas as NASIC's next commander. Lauterbach is currently the commander of the 67th Cyberspace Operations Group, which is responsible for offensive cyber attacks on the part of the Air Force. NASIC spokesman James Lunford says Lauterbach has roots in the Miami Valley.
Interestingly enough, she actually grew up in the Dayton area, and her father worked at the Foreign Technology Division. Now, the Foreign Technology Division was a predecessor organization to NASIC, so for her, she says it feels like coming home.
NASIC is based at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Its role is to analyze intelligence about foreign air, space, missile, and cybersecurity threats and share information with Washington policymakers, warfighters, and other parts of the Air Force. It employs about 3,000 military and civilian personnel and has a budget of over $330 million. It's the last week to sign up for health plans under the Affordable Care Act. The deadline is Monday, March 31st. That's tomorrow. But as WISO's Lewis Wallace reports, last week was marked with confusion and more wiggle room on the deadline.
As of March 1st, about 180,000 people in Ohio had gotten new health coverage either from the federal marketplace or Medicaid. A trickle, not a flood. But the procrastinators are stepping up. Michelle Nelson at the Community Action Partnership in Dayton says people are filing in and out of their lobby all day, every day, to sign up and to clear up confusion.
Bad information spreads really fast, and I'm hearing some pretty wild stories.
She says lots of people have no idea they could qualify for free or subsidized care, or that they could owe steep fines if they don't enroll.
I hear a lot of, well, that's really too complicated. I'm just going to opt out. I'm going to pay the $95 fine. It's not a choice. It's not an opt out. It's not an option.
That's because $95 is the minimum fine, and it goes up from there based on income to hundreds or even thousands per year. And the whole point is to discourage people from thinking they can opt out. Now, Health and Human Services says they'll offer extensions for people who start the application process before March 31st but can't complete it in time. Lewis Wallace, WISO.
Monthly unemployment numbers are out for Ohio and for the Miami Valley. In our next segment, Lewis spoke with WISO News Director Emily McCord about some of the latest job trends, which range from low labor force participation to pizza.
Jobs numbers for the region are out for February. Did we learn anything surprising?
Nothing too surprising. The unemployment rate has been on a steady downward tick for quite a while now. It was 8.3% a year ago this time for the greater Dayton area. Now it's about 6.9%. It's going down pretty much in line with Ohio and with the country.
So that suggests some good news then?
Yeah, that's definitely good news. At the same time, we've been seeing a trend also for quite a while now in the Dayton area of people who are looking for work leaving the workforce. And so that could mean people moving away, giving up the search, or maybe retiring. About 10 years ago, and back in 2003, we had 430,000 people who were either working or looking for work in the Dayton area. In the same month in 2014, that number was recorded at 40,000 less people.
The idea that people are retiring or maybe not looking for work, I mean, what can we read from that as an economic indicator? Is this just that the population is getting older, or is this that people are losing hope in the workforce in the area?
It's hard to really assess on an individual level. Overall, though, for economic growth, we don't just want to see a better percentage. We want to see more jobs and more workers, because that means people moving to the greater Dayton area, people feeling like this is a hopeful place to be. Maybe people come here to go to college and then they stay as opposed to leave, and the actual labor force gets bigger. So that would definitely be a positive indicator, and that's not one that we're seeing right now.
When we're looking at the region, are there differences in different parts of the region in terms of economic growth?
Yeah, so the unemployment rates really do kind of vary from county to county. Montgomery County has about a 7% unemployment rate right now. Greene County, on the other hand, is down at 6.3%, and Clark is at 6.2% unemployment. Basically, all of those are kind of hugging the average rate across Ohio, which dropped to 6.5% in February.
Okay, so people are leaving the workforce, which can make the job rate go down. But there is some job growth, correct?
Yeah, and that job growth is measured in a number of different ways. We see those numbers go up and down and this way and that way. Tom Mayer, who's with Manpower Dayton, is involved with a quarterly survey of companies who say they're going to be hiring in the coming quarter. So Tom Mayer says that manufacturing is a big area of growth. There are a lot of manufacturers who are hiring right now.
Those employers, and they're mostly small to medium-sized employers, they're really in quite desperate need of individuals to step in and begin working within their environments. There is some pre-training. It's a skilled job, not a non-skilled job, but makes for a good career for somebody.
That's Tom Mayer with Manpower Dayton talking about the need for manufacturing workers in the greater Dayton area. And we actually just heard the news last week that Whirlpool is expanding its kitchen appliance factory in Greenville. They say they'll be adding 400 jobs going into the future.
What other jobs are coming to the Miami Valley right now?
Well, some of them are surprising. CareSource is supposed to be hiring another couple hundred people in the coming year or so. CareSource is a health insurance company that's involved with the expansion of the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid plans and health plans for low-income people. Another area that we're seeing some expansion is leisure and hospitality and the restaurant industry, food. So among other things, we've got a new Dewey's, a new Godfather's, Jet's Pizza, and Pies and Pints, all pizza locations opening up in the Dayton area in the coming months.
Wait, okay, why all the pizza?
You know, it's a trend for sure. Ohio, I learned, is the eighth in the country for pizza stores per capita. So I guess we like our pizza. And gourmet pizza is also on the rise nationally. A lot of places are experimenting with kind of fancier lines of pizza.
Okay, so this begs the question, are there just more pizza eaters out there, or are these just pizza joints taking customers away from other pizza places?
Well, there hasn't been a unified survey of pizza eaters in the United States that I know of, but between 2012 and 2013, the U.S. pizza industry grew somewhere between 1% and 4%. So it sounds like people are eating more pizza.
That's WISO's economics reporter Lewis Wallace and news director Emily McCord talking about the latest unemployment numbers for the state. You can find out more at WYSO.org. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up, Emily will be back with Politics Ohio. But first, on Thursday night, the first of four events hosted by the Community Initiative to Reduce Gun Violence, or CIRV, took place in Dayton's Westwood neighborhood. Sean Walton with the Dayton Human Relations Council is CIRV's program director and says there are disturbing trends taking place in Dayton neighborhoods. It's not all bad news, though. I spoke with him about what the program is trying to do. Sean, you've been here with the Human Relations Council since July. Tell me a little bit about your mandate here.
My mandate is to work with our multi-jurisdictional effort. We work with community members, faith-based organizations, businesses, also actual residents to reduce gun violence. So part of my job is to make sure that our community engagement team is actively involved in neighborhoods and engaging residents in the fight to reduce gun violence, arming them with, tools and different things they can use, email, text message, all those things in the effort to reduce violence.
What were some of the early challenges with this position?
Well, early challenges, it's an enormous project because you've got our community engagement team that I talked about. That's only one arm. We also have our CIRV services team, which involves street advocates that canvass the community and act as violence interrupters and spread the anti-violence message. And we also have our law enforcement partners. That's Montgomery County Sheriff's Department, Dayton Police Department, and Trotwood Police Department. So when you're talking about county and city agencies, and you're talking about nonprofits and community leaders, a lot of folks, they have understandably their own priorities that they've been working with. So I guess the largest challenge was to, you know, try to really block out some time in everyone's schedule so that I could make sure that everyone's values were adequately reflected in our SERVE initiative.
Well, let me ask you a personal question. Are you from Dayton, or did you move here and have to familiarize yourself with the area?
I am from Dayton, Ohio, born and raised. I actually volunteered for the SERVE initiative in 2008, from 2008 until the time that I took the official position on the community engagement team. I worked almost 10 years with Community Action Partnership of the Greater Dayton Area as a director of youth initiatives, and also did a lot of community outreach and community engagement activities.
There is an event coming up Thursday. It's an affair to end gun violence. And let's talk about that event. It will have taken place by the time this full interview airs, but we want to talk about the reasons for this event and how important it is.
Sure. Well, our Neighborhood Affair to Reduce Gun Violence is a real grassroots level with also the support of institutions. So what we'd like to do on March 27th is we're meeting with the Westwood neighborhood. We're meeting with faith-based leaders in that area, the actual residents of that area, the school, and some service providers as well. The purpose of that event is, one, of course, to talk about crime trends, you know, to look at what's happening with gun violence. While, you know, over a decade, gun violence has dropped some, but of course, we still have, you know, far too many incidents of gun violence. And we'd like to highlight and talk a little bit about the SERVE initiative, but also give neighbors an opportunity to ask law enforcement questions about process and what they should do if they hear gunshots, what sort of support or response should they expect from police, that sort of thing. And then we also want to connect residents with valuable services. So we've got a services fair where we'll have providers, folks from Montgomery County Victim Witness, Goodwill Easter Seals. We've got folks there from the Fatherhood Initiative, just a host of different folks where we can actually connect people directly to services. And finally, we'll actually do have a next steps information session where we'll be meeting. I believe it's April 5th, if that's a Saturday. But, you know, a couple of Saturdays immediately following the event, we'll do a mini training for the neighbors there on how to spread the anti-violence message through a community canvassing.
Is there a particular reason you're going to Westwood, or is it just one of many neighborhoods that you're working on through this process?
We will actually follow. It's one of many neighborhoods that we'll visit. Of course, you know, we follow general crime stats, so we will make it to all neighborhoods. Most neighborhoods have their issues, things that they deal with, but we see a great energy, you know, in the Westwood neighborhood. There's some folks already in there doing some great work. There are some resources, some assets available. And, you know, we just think that Westwood is a great community, and we'd like to make sure that community is as safe as it can be.
Geographically, explain where Westwood is for our listeners.
Sure. Westwood is on in the southwest area of Dayton, Ohio. It's in the southeast of the Southwest Priority Board area. I guess the nearest main streets would be 3rd Street in Gettysburg. Westwood is a community. If folks know about Residence Park, where Thurgood Marshall High School is, of course, we're having the event at Westwood Pre-K school there. And I guess some other folks where Revival Center Ministries, you know, is a large church in that area. So, you know, folks who understand those entities, those kind of mainstays there in that neighborhood. Westwood is a community with a long history of residents that actually care. And now is the time for us to bring those residents outside the house and start to work with those residents and in defining what they want their community to be.
That's actually similar to trends going on in other neighborhoods like Five Oaks. You've got a lot of people there pulling together to revive that neighborhood. Is this a growing trend that you see?
I do. There's a lot of conversation around rebuilding neighborhoods and bringing neighborhoods back. You know, residents just need some extra direction at times. They have the ideas. They have the energy. They know what they want. However, they may lack the information to carry things out. So we're here to act as a support, lend information, add training and technical support wherever possible. And we want to create sustainable networks of residents that can also feed into programs that are already there, you know, Citizens Police Academy, involved with the Southwest Priority Boards, to get involved with local churches, to volunteer right there at this school. There's parent organizations there. So not only do we want to build those new networks and new relationships directly to reduce violence and reduce gun violence specifically, but we also want to funnel individuals into those things that already exist.
By sustainable, I imagine that you're saying this isn't just a one-shot message. You're going to keep at this constantly, and you want that message to always be with these folks in these neighborhoods.
Definitely. We want to create many leaders. And part of our thing is training and education and reminding residents that they can do this, without big organization. We're there to support, to provide training, but definitely you don't want this to be a one-shot thing. Like I said, I volunteered since 2008. So the SERVE initiative is near and dear to my heart. It wasn't a mandate for me. It was a passion. So I know that there's other folks out there. I've talked to those individuals that have that same passion. And we want to encourage folks and give them the tools to make this a regular thing that doesn't just deal with gun violence and negative things, but to also highlight and support our young people that are in those neighborhoods and support our seniors.
There are good news coming out of these neighborhoods, but let's talk about trends currently taking place in Dayton with gun violence in mind. Tell me what's going on here in the city.
Sure. Well, it's not just Dayton, but of course, since we're the largest area, it's going to be a high concentration. You've got, once again, kind of the old thing. You've got a bunch of people dying far too young. While our shootings were up, or our homicides were up slightly last year in Dayton. SERVE worked specifically with our group member involved homicides, and those are still down. We've had somewhere around an 86% drop since the SERVE initiative started in 2008. But to lose one life is far too many. But, as we can see with many crimes, I mean, where there's crime, there's eventually going to be violence. So we want to make sure that we stay on top of things. So in Westwood and in many different places, we're finding that young people are getting involved in gun violence younger. That's a trend. And we're finding that they don't know enough about the consequences and they don't really understand the value of life. So we're looking forward to working with neighbors and making sure that we turn that trend around by not only making sure that it doesn't increase to affect our young people, but our young people, as they grow older, will see the effect on the entire community.
Sean Walton with Dayton Human Relations Council and the Community Initiative to Reduce Gun Violence.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. One aspect of Governor Kasich's midterm budget is to raise taxes on oil and gas drillers. The proposal has put him at odds with some members of his own party, people in the industry, and liberals as well. And this is all ahead of the election next fall. Andy Chow from Ohio Public Radio's Statehouse News Bureau says there are now two proposals being debated at the Statehouse.
One is in the form of a House bill from Representative Matt Huffman from the Lima area. He is now proposing a 2.25% on these companies, and pretty much it's a percentage of the oil and gas that's extracted from Ohio's lands. And the governor has a different proposal, and that would be a 2.75%. And so right now that's where the debate is. Should they go with a 2.25% or should they go with a 2.75%?
2.25% versus 2.75%, is this really that big a difference?
That's what I asked Tom Stewart. He's the executive vice president for Ohio Oil and Gas Association, also known as OOGA. And he says it really does make a big difference, especially when you go with what the original proposal was, which was 2%. And he said that 0.75% difference really does make a big difference when you're talking about a large amount of money. And when you have a lot of oil and gas companies coming in, it does make a huge difference in their opinion.
One reason that Governor Kasich is doing this is to lower the income tax. This tax on oil and gas drillers is meant to offset that cost. Do we have a sense of how much this tax will actually generate?
Their breakdown from his budget update, also known as the mid-biennium review, had a breakdown of all the numbers in his proposals. And as far as the severance tax goes, his proposal says that in fiscal year 2015, the increased severance tax will raise $121 million. Then in fiscal year 2016, it'll raise $304 million. And then by 2017, $449 million. So we're talking about a lot of money coming in just from this one industry because of this whole boom, this whole shale gas boom with hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling and getting all the natural gas out of the shale. The governor says he wants to capitalize on that. And when we're talking about in the next three fiscal years, nearly $880 million. That's a lot of money.
We hear from some Republican lawmakers that are really worried about this tax on sort of a nascent kind of budding oil and gas industry here in Ohio. How does Ohio compare in terms of its taxes on oil and gas drillers to other states?
That's the other really big debate that's going on right now. The Ohio Business Roundtable brought in a study from Ernst & Young that said, well, this 2.75% is still, I believe they said, 65% lower than seven other top drilling states. But the industry says you just can't compare the two because Ohio is very different than any other state. And they say every state can never be compared to any other state because of the geology, because of the industry infrastructure already there. And the other thing that's interesting is that because it's so new in Ohio, Ohio's still in its what they're calling its infancy stage of drilling. So while you have a state like maybe Oklahoma or Texas that have higher rates, they have an industry that's been going on for a while now. So they already have a lot of things developed, and they say Ohio's just not as far developed.
You know, in the past few weeks, we've seen an oil spill in southwest Ohio, and there was a series of earthquakes in Youngstown that may or may not be related to fracking. I wonder, though, could this change the political discussion surrounding these taxes?
It's hard to say at this point if that's going to play a role at all. It does play a role, especially for some liberal-leaning think tanks. For example, Policy Matters says that is why we need a higher rate. They would like to see Ohio go for no less than a 5% severance tax rate. And they say raising that rate up to that level will generate enough money to be able to mitigate some long-term concerns. For example, if even though they are rare, if something were to happen like a leak or a spill or anything like that, this fund, the money that goes into this fund can help pay for that kind of stuff. And Wendy Patton with Policy Matters brought up the West Virginia example, the example of a chemical spill in the river, and how the state is constantly paying a lot of money in order to compensate for all the issues that they're having right now in that area.
I've been speaking with Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks again for joining us. Today on Reinvention Stories, we visit Trotwood, west of Dayton, which has undergone dramatic change in recent years with the closure of the Salem Mall. There's a home for teenage mothers in Trotwood, part of a nonprofit called the Mustard Seed Foundation. It's a place where mothers can live with their babies as they try and build a stable future. It was founded by a former teen mom, Shondell Atkinson, whose own reinvention is where the story of the Mustard Seed Foundation begins.
Shondell Atkinson was in and out of Montgomery County's foster care system for most of her childhood. Sometimes she lived at local homeless shelters with her birth mom, who was battling crack addiction in the 80s. But often she lived with foster parents, which is where she was when she got pregnant at 17.
The day I gave birth to my daughter, my caseworker showed up at the hospital and said, "Hey, by the way, you and your daughter both cannot go back to the foster home. Only your daughter is being requested to come back. And the foster parent is changing her focus on now wanting infants and toddlers." And I was like, okay, what does that mean? What does that look like?
A year later, Shondell got her baby back and moved into low-income housing. She says that while Montgomery County Social Services made sure she had a stable life, no one told her how to have a better life. It made her angry.
No one had talked to me about graduating from high school. It wasn't imperative that I learn parenting skills. It was pretty much like, oh, okay, well, yeah, you achieved some of your goals, so here's your baby back, and hey, good luck.
Shondell worked hard to break the poverty cycle she had grown up in. She moved her family out of low-income housing, and her anger about her childhood began to fade. It was replaced with a calling to help young women like her. She wanted to start a home for teenage mothers in the foster care system, a place where young women could live with their babies and go to school.
So when I got ready to branch out and say, hey, I want to start this agency, everybody's like, who are you? And Montgomery County Children's Services is like, oh, well, she's the crack baby that used to be here at foster care. Remember her?
Shondell didn't get the encouragement she felt she deserved, but she also lacked some important skills.
I couldn't tell anybody that I didn't know what a business plan was. Or people would say, hey, send me that in a Word document. And I'm like, what's a Word document? I seemed to have a pretty my head on pretty straight. My girls were in Catholic schools. I was the PTA president. I did a lot of stuff, but none of it required me to cut on a computer and type up anything.
In her search for partner organizations, a friend introduced Shondell to the Sisters of the Precious Blood in Trotwood. They gave the Mustard Seed Foundation a home in a yellow house on the edge of their campus. Since 2010, dozens of mothers and their kids have come through the yellow house. Most of the young women at the Mustard Seed Foundation are going on to college and aren't reliant on social services. Shondell is their advocate and in many cases a stand-in parent, like the time she accompanied one young woman to the delivery room.
She's like, Miss Shondell, you know, can you please stay in a room with me? Can you, you know, can you be, you know, my mom? And so, and I'm like, okay. And I got her mother on the phone, and that was the first time I'd ever spoke with her mother. And her mother just had a genuine, you know, just thank you for being there for my baby. And I could only imagine as a mother who, you know, made many mistakes. I mean, you know, things happen in life. But the day that your baby girl wants you here, needs you here, it gave me great joy in my heart, pleasure to know that I could stand in and that you trust me.
Shondell has become the type of advocate she needed when she was a teen mom. It's rewarding, but exhausting.
Is that a hard thing to admit sometimes, that today I am worn out, I am just tired, but I'm gonna bounce back? Is that hard to sometimes admit both to yourself and to the girls?
Admitting being tired was something I wasn't taught. I need to be able to show them some days that I'm tired. I'm not going to tell you to do something that I ain't had to do myself.
As the Mustard Seed Foundation grows, Shondell is expanding its programming to include outreach at preventing teen pregnancy and building self-esteem in young women. But the heart of her work remains in the yellow house with the mothers and children who live there.
And when they walk out of here together and they don't have a need coming out of this agency, that's the glory of God.
For WYSO, I'm Juliette Frumholdt.
Major funding for the second season of Reinvention Stories comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with support from Wright State University's Celia Fund and the Yellow Springs Community Foundation and Antioch College. 101 years ago this week, it rained in Dayton, and it rained some more, and it kept on raining. That rain led to the Great Dayton Flood. Today, though, because of a man named Arthur E. Morgan, communities from Piqua to Hamilton have little to fear from rising floodwaters of the Great Miami River. In our continuing series, Rediscovered Radio, Archives Fellow Jocelyn Robinson shares some historic audio and explores one aspect of Morgan's continuing legacy, one we tend to overlook.
Arthur Ernest Morgan was an Antioch College president who hadn't ever earned a degree himself. A self-taught hydrologist who once chaired the largest civil engineering project of its time, the Tennessee Valley Authority. He was a utopian thinker, a 19th century man driven by an ethical purpose who sounds formal and reserved to our 21st century ears. Here he is in the early 1960s giving testimony in support of the Seneca Indians who didn't want to give up their land for a Pennsylvania flood control project.
The study which located the Kinzer site for control of the upper Allegheny was inadequate and entirely overlooked by far the best possibility. Because the Kinzua Reservoir would take most of the habitable land of the Seneca Nation held under a treaty signed by George Washington, the president of the Seneca Indians asked me to advise them whether it was necessary to take their reservation to protect Pittsburgh. They stated that if it should be necessary, they would not oppose it. I found a greatly superior possibility which had been wholly overlooked by the Corps.
We have several recordings of Arthur Morgan in the WYSO archives. Antioch College also has an extensive collection of his papers. I'm in the Morgan Room at Antioch's library with archivist Scott Sanders to learn more about this remarkable man who died in 1975 at the age of 97.
We're really fortunate that Morgan kept so much of the paper that he generated over his long and very productive career.
Arthur Morgan is well known for reviving Antioch College back in the 1920s, and for inspiring its innovative cooperative education program. But it's his work as an engineer that first brought him to the Dayton area and leaves us today with an enduring reminder of his genius.
Morgan's most lasting contribution to the Miami Valley is a system of earthen dams we call the Miami Conservancy District. In 1913, this area was, and much of the Midwest, was devastated by floods. Dayton's situation was so bad that the people that ran the city resolved to it would never happen again and hired an open casting call, really, for engineers to come up with a flood control solution. Arthur Morgan, when asked what his solution would be, his answer was, "I won't know until I've walked the land." So he had to actually see what the situation was before he came up with a solution. He did, and from the time the Conservancy District went online in 1919, it has held back hundreds of serious floods, maybe some that could have been as big as the Great Dayton Flood.
When Morgan walked the land, he had a larger vision. Four of the five containment dams in the Conservancy District, Taylorsville, Germantown, Huffman, and Englewood, formed the first areas developed into what is now Five Rivers Metro Parks. It's an extensive network of land devoted to conservation and recreation.
The genius of the system is the legal authority of the Conservancy law, which permitted a system of eminent domain to take lands in the floodplain and to have on the flooded side of the dams, dry reservoirs. They were really only there to hold flood waters when flood waters came, which wasn't so often. Therefore, a system of river parks was created, open and available to the public. So it's a marvelous combination of Morgan's gift for the law, his engineering technique, and also his desire for service to community, kind of all in one single package.
I took a drive out to Taylorsville Dam in Vandalia, where US 40, the old national road, tops this wall of earth on its east-west route. I'm looking out at the cold and muddy Great Miami River floodplain over 70 feet below at Arthur E. Morgan's simple yet elegant solution. Soon, the threat of spring flooding will subside, and the park will fill instead with sunshine, with picnickers, hikers, cyclists, birdwatchers, and dog walkers. But until then, let it rain. For Rediscovered Radio at WYSO, I'm Jocelyn Robinson.
Major support for Rediscovered Radio comes from the Ohio Humanities Council and the Greene County Public Library. That's it for this week's edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to WYSO. Coming up next, The Book Nook.